Today is Monday, March 22nd, 2010. You're listening to News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening and thanks for being with us. Today in Campus News, we bring you our regular feature with UBC reporters to bring you the latest coverage from the campus newspaper. Also in Campus News, we'll be bringing you coverage of the Arts Last Lecture, an event for graduating Faculty of Arts students. We'll also be bringing you coverage of the International Relations Student Association's upcoming Global Health and Human Security Conference. In National News, we'll be bringing you an interview with Ihsan Gardi of the Canadian Council on American-Islamic Relations for an update on the ongoing Omar Khadr case. We'll have all this, plus your CITR and Free Speech Radio news headlines and your weekday weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. First up, we go to UBC reporters who are in the studio to bring you headlines from the pages of the campus newspaper.
Thank you very much. So in today's news, Arati Sharma has resigned from her position as National Director of the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations, or CASA. An email from CASA Chair Tina Robichaud was sent to several CASA member associations on the afternoon of March 15th, explaining that Sharma had handed in a letter of resignation. The resignation was officially confirmed by Robichaud in a separate statement, which indicated that Sharma has chosen not to seek a second term, and noted a resignation will come into effect on April 1st, 2010. The position of National Director is elected for no more than 2 years.
The correct results of the AMS elections have been disclosed to the public, and newly elected Senate Representative Nader Bizet feels that fellow candidate Elisa Cohen has been left behind. The Elections Committee revealed on Wednesday night that Cohen won the final spot as student senator. Original numbers placed Bizet and Cohen at 1,715 and 1,340 votes, respectively. However, that updated poll count maintains Cohen at 1,340 votes, but brings Bizet down to 984, barely over half his original number. The Elections Committee is maintaining the previous decisions until the university, which oversees the Senate elections, has finished their own investigation. Council also, in the same meeting, amended changes to the voter-funded media contest by voting in favor of allowing $900 more worth of money to be distributed among affected student media groups. No money was taken away from Social Capital and UBC Spectator, the two VFM groups that benefited from the extra votes. The results of the referendum question regarding the AMS tuition policy that passed is still under investigation, however, with initial results showing that after the changes made, the question was six short of reaching quorum. The AMS has spent approximately $43,000 so far in the investigation, a number that will grow until it's concluded, with two-thirds going towards legal counsel from Davis LLP and one-third for forensic data recovery, the audit company hired to investigate the voting irregularities.
Bruce Weisner is the new Associate Dean for the Sauder School of Business. Weisner was previously the Senior Vice President of Sales at Canada Wide Media Limited, the largest independently owned magazine publishing company in Western Canada. He's also a UBC alumnus, having earned his Bachelor of Commerce for Marketing in 1987. Sauter Dean Daniel Mazuka welcomes Wisner as he joins us to further accelerate the growth of our world-class and globally connected business school.
Thanks for that, Paul. According to a press release in the Times Colonist, UBC is looking for land for studying sustainable light logging and other forester research. 18 months ago, UBC made an offer for $50 million on land located on Vancouver Island. Land was formerly licensed to tree farming by Western Forest Products, but the offer by UBC was rejected by WFT as the company was looking for a higher price, closer to $120 million. UBC VP External, Legal and Community Relations Stephen Owen said that UBC will continue its hunt, but also hopes that the province will step in to help support their project. And for Paul Bucci, I'm Justin McElroy, and thanks very much.
And thank you to both Justin and Paul for that coverage. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us for more independent news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to News 101. In more campus news, Katie Comley joins us in studio to discuss the 2010 Arts Last Lecture. Thanks for being with us, Katie. And also, Katie is a former co-news director.
Yes.
Was it a co-directorship at the time?
Yeah, it was a co-directorship back in the day in 2007, I guess. I was here with News 101. It was good times.
Well, great to have you with us.
Thanks.
So now you're here to talk about the Arts Last Lecture. Can you tell us first what it is?
Arts Last Lecture is the premier graduating event for all students, graduating students in the Faculty of Arts. Basically, we take a day and get a notable Canadian with an arts degree to come and impart some words of wisdom on the graduating students. And it's a really great opportunity to sort of cap off the year with one final lecture.
And so this year, can you tell us who the speaker is? And can you tell us also maybe what the lecture will be on or maybe the title?
Sure. Yeah. This year's speaker, we're very, very lucky and honored to present Mark Tewksbury. And for those of you who don't know who Mark Tewksbury is, he's a former Canadian Olympian. He actually won gold medal in the backstroke in Barcelona Summer Olympic Games, I believe, in 1992. Besides that, he's also took a very controversial stand against the Olympics. He stood up against the IOC for their in advocation of athletes' rights in sport. He's the former president of the World Out Games, and he's a board member of the Gay and Lesbian Athletic Association. He's the recipient of an honorary doctorate of law by the University of Western Ontario, and besides all of his many humanitarian and academic achievements, he, for a short time, was the host of the show How It's Made, for those of you who don't know him from his other achievements. And his talk is going to focus on just Mark's words of wisdom. He's a motivational speaker that was actually sent to speak to the Canadian Olympic athletes before the start of the Vancouver Games, and he's just sort of about setting your goals in a very personal manner and how you'd like to live your life. So I think he's going to have some good things to share with us.
And now, who have some of the past, we'll come back to talk about him a bit more, but who have some of the past speakers been for this event?
Well, last year's speaker was Kyle MacDonald, who those of you may know him from his time here as a student at UBC, but he is the one red paperclip guy, traded a paperclip all the way up to get a house in Saskatchewan. Past years have also featured Peter Mansbridge, CBC anchor, author Douglas Copeland, and Canadian filmmaker Giselle Pointier.
And this year, especially with Vancouver hosting the Olympics, and I want to actually have you talk about why he took a more controversial stand on the games and challenging the IOC. But why was he chosen to speak, and And how is it significant what person the committee chooses for this lecture?
Well, we figured that Mark, not only because Vancouver is just coming off the Olympics, but Mark's has taken his life in very many different directions, all of which, not cater, that's not the right word, but appeal to different sections of our arts student body. He is an Olympian, which some students may identify with, but he also has serious reservations with some aspects of the Olympic movement, including how the bids are handled, how athletes that are either gay or lesbian are treated within sport. Also his... and so those were just basically the two major reasons why we figured he would be an appropriate speaker. He would appeal to either side of sort of that, you know, polarizing opinion that sort of rocked UBC's campus this year. And he's just a very, very articulate, welcoming person. And he was actually approached us, the committee, interestingly enough, and he really wanted to be a part of this event. So we figured if he was enthusiastic, why not?
Great. And is there input from students about this event and who comes to bring students the lecture? Or is it, like, how's, just let us know sort of what the process is for that selection. And obviously this year sounds like it was a bit of a different scenario because he approached the committee.
Yeah, well, we did have, obviously the committee has to negotiate what choices of speakers they'd like. And that's a really difficult process that can take very many months. We were lucky that Mark ended up coming to us, but... essentially, what happens is an email went out, I think, at the beginning of the year calling for people to be a part of the committee. Students are selected from every department in the Faculty of Arts. We, in turn, approach our friends in different organizations that we're personally involved in and sort of get a feeling of who people would like for the lecture. And then from there, we make an executive decision on behalf of the committee.
Great. And so how can students, graduating arts students, get tickets? It's only for graduating students, is that right?
It is. Right now, tickets are available for graduating students primarily. If you're a non-graduating student and you really, really want to come, of course we will give you a ticket. We're not going to turn anyone away. Closer to the event, more tickets will be made available for all UBC students. It sort of goes in descending order, graduating students, arts students, non-arts students, etc. So just stay posted to, I guess, our social media outlets, which I'll explain in a minute for where and when you can get tickets.
Yeah, do you want to go right into that? Where can graduating students pick up a ticket?
Sure. Today we actually were in front of Buchanan Tower handing out tickets, and we will be doing that again on March 30th. If you're a graduating student, stop by, get your free ticket. I repeat, they're free. And free Rocky Mountain chocolate to go with your ticket. Also, tickets are available from Arts Advising and from the Center for Student Involvement in Brock Hall.
Great, and it's going to be at the Chan Center?
At the Chan Center, April 13th from 12:30 to 3:30, and tickets will be made available at the door on the day of, if you're also interested.
Great. Well, Katie, thanks so much for coming in. Any last comments, thoughts?
I hope you all come. It's a fantastic event. We're looking forward to seeing you there. And also check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and our WordPress website, which is artslastlecture.wordpress.com.
You're all over the place.
We are all over the social media.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Katie. Appreciate
thanks.
It. And thanks for Katie for joining us in studio. We're going to take a quick break for some public service announcements, but stay with us.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
What is that? What is it? One more shot, a salute.
Sore Throats, Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet. Monday at midnight on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end,
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
SpongeBob! You're wasting me precious carbon dioxide! I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy! Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool!
Ooh, the endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable! Big business does it again!
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And welcome back to News 101. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and at streaming online at citr.ca. This afternoon, News co-director Brad Pepping spoke with Lauren Mills about the International Student Association's upcoming Global Health and Human Security Conference. Here's the conversation they had earlier this afternoon.
So I'm in the studio today with Lauren Mills. So Lauren, can you tell me a little bit about this upcoming event that you guys are hosting on behalf of IRSA, the International Relations Students Association? What are you guys doing this coming week?
Well, we have a lot of events this week. This isn't our only one, but this is one of our bigger ones. So what's happening is, together with Doctors Without Borders, UBC, the International Relations Students Association is going to be holding a Global Health and Human Security Conference. This is going to be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
And so can you tell me a little bit about what this is? What are you guys hoping to do, and what exactly are you hoping to kind of address? What's global health?
Yeah, so one thing we wanted to do by collaborating with this conference is to try to focus on the interdisciplinary nature of international relations and how it kind of branches out to other fields, such as medicine and health. So with this conference specifically, we're looking at the lack of access to essential medicines and the impact that that has on human security.
Okay. And so MSF is one of those organizations that you know, works with people. They do actual concrete physical work, but they also advocate on behalf of people who might be you know, not as well off as us. So you know, IRSA as well as MSF, how are you guys trying to address this in your conference?
So we're going to address the issue by delving into the different aspects of global governance and the governance of access to medicine. So we're going to be looking at, for instance, the research gaps. So why diseases like breast cancer get so much more funding than African sleeping sickness, for example. We're also going to be looking at intellectual property rights and the patent system and how agreements such as the TRIPS agreement under the WTO framework prevent people from producing, say, generic drugs that can be used by the poor around the world. We're also going to be talking about the role of universities and groups like Universities Allied for Essential Medicines and the role that they play in researching and producing these generic drugs, potentially. And we're also going to be looking at the broader impacts of humans on human security.
So this sounds really quite interesting, but the one thing that I'm getting out of this is that, you know, it sounds really just so professional. And what's really neat is that, you know, IRSA is a student group and MSF on campus is a student group. And so how are you finding it as students organizing this type of really important event where you're addressing these really significant issues? Because obviously universities do play a role, and that's what you will be addressing during the conference. But were you just kind of inspired by what's going on and you decided that your two groups would work together to create this conference? Or is it, have you had many other conferences like this?
IRSA typically runs a policy conference every 2 years. So we've had ones on the World Bank before, and we had one 3 years ago about failing, fragile, and failing states. So we have experience planning conferences. But this year, what happened actually in the summer was that our president was taking a summer course with the president of Doctors Without Borders. And so they met and just decided that they had this shared interest in running a really cool conference. So that's how it came together.
So I guess, can you maybe touch on the ways in the past conferences that you've had? How much kind of impression have they left? You know, are they just kind of one of your typical conferences where everyone gets together, has a good time, and addresses issues that they already know about? Is it, to an extent, preaching to the choir, or is there something tangible that will be kind of produced at the end of this conference?
Well, the thing that's different about this particular conference is that it's interdisciplinary. It's the first interdisciplinary conference that we've done. So if you look at the delegates who have registered so far, we have students from nursing, we have students from global resource systems, international relations, medicine. So it's a really broad range. And so what we hope to do with this conference is just get people together and get them to think about issues in ways that they may have not thought about them before.
Right.
And we're also hoping to produce some kind of policy recommendations at the end of it. We're going to have some breakout sessions and get into writing. So,
well, that's really quite interesting. And so, you know, you do have this one event coming up this weekend, but as you mentioned, URSA does quite a bit. Is there anything else that you guys are doing during this school year? Is this kind of your big hoopla? Is everything kind of culminating this weekend?
No, actually, this week we have many events. Today at 5 in the Global Lounge, which is under Marine Drive residents, we're having a debriefing session for those of you who went to the Paul Recessa Begina talk last week, which is part of iWeek. We're also having a career fair for people interested in careers in international relations. That's tomorrow night, 5:30 p.m. at the Global Lounge. And we're also going to be holding our elections quite soon. Those will be happening on April 7th. So if you're interested, you can send me a shout at URSA, IRSA.VPI. Because I'm the vice president internal at gmail.com.
Great. Well, before you go, I want to touch on two issues, if you don't mind. First, the talk that you're talking about, that you'd mentioned, that you're kind of having the debrief tonight, that was part of the International Week. We had the folks from the International Week down to our studio last week, and they told us about what was going on, and they're really quite excited by this. They were showing the movie Hotel Rwanda. And to my understanding, the speaker is the man who Don Cheadle's character is based on. Were you able to attend that event?
Did you see him speak? Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to see him speak?
It was really interesting to see him speak. It was actually a little bit controversial. It got more controversial towards the end. His own speech was about his experiences throughout the genocide, and it wasn't very analytical, I guess, on the events and what could be done. It started to get a little bit more analytical towards the end, and as an IR student, that's what I was more interested in.
So controversial, what do you mean?
Well, there were actually genocide survivors in the audience who had come from the larger Vancouver community, and their concern is that Paul's story has been kind of Hollywoodified, you know? It's like too much of a Hollywood portrayal of the genocide, and it doesn't reveal some of the more intricate political, like, circumstances surrounding the situation.
And so some of the participants, did they address those issues? Did they bring that up, and how did Paul respond if they did?
They did try to bring them up, actually. Dr. Byers, who is the moderator at the session, cut the session off right at 1:30 when it was scheduled to end, and there were still people with questions. And they stayed at the end to address the audience and tell them their point of view. And they thought that Paul, because it's actually controversial, because Paul Recessa Begina is currently kind of having arguments with the Kagame regime in Rwanda, so they're trying to address kind of where both sides were coming from.
Interesting.
There, yeah.
And lastly, just on another somewhat related note, we've been kind of a theme that we've been talking about for the last few weeks. We had the members of STAND in our studio, Students Taking Action Now Darfur, to talk about their use of the Global Lounge. And obviously, URSA is a group that uses the Global Lounge as well. Can you tell us about being involved in the process of initiating the Global Lounge? To my understanding, you were a student before the Global Lounge was here, and now that it is here, is there a big difference? How do you feel as a group using that? How important is it to use the Global Lounge?
I think the most important function of the Global Lounge for URSA is just being able to network with all these other student groups who are interested in the same issues. Because what happens is, to kind of govern or manage the Global Lounge and kind of, like, you know, who can use the photocopier when and all those small issues, which could turn into big ones, you never know. But we get together about once a month with Yola, who's the coordinator of the Student Lounge. She works with iHouse also, and she's great. And we all get together and talk about these things, but it gives us an opportunity to share with other involved, interested students what we're doing. And it's really interesting to see what all the other groups on campus are doing, because I don't get a lot of that just being so focused on URSA. So.
Right. And before we go, do you have any final comments? Anything else that you want to pass on to our listeners?
If you're interested in the Global Health and Human Security Conference, don't forget it starts this Friday, and the registration, your registration should be in by Thursday, March 25th. The registration cost is $20, which covers wine at the opening keynote reception and also food for 2 days. So it's pretty good. And you can check it out at www.ghhs2010.ca.
Cool. Well, thanks so much.
And thanks to Brad for bringing us that coverage. The current time is 5:24, and it's time for your weekday weather. For that, we turn now to Daniel Casanova. Thanks for being with us, Daniel.
Thanks, Andrew. Well, there's a high-pressure system to the southwest that will keep most of the ugly weather in the Pacific away from us for a couple of days, but expect conditions to worsen come Thursday. We can expect warmer nights this week as the temperature won't be dropping below 4 degrees. The normal temperatures for this time of year are highs of 11 degrees and lows of 4. Here's your weekday weather forecast. Monday evening to the overnight, it will be cloudy with a low of 4. For Tuesday, it will be cloudy in the morning and afternoon, but clearing late in the day. High of 11 degrees, low of 5. On Wednesday, we will experience a mix of sun and clouds with a high of 13 and low of 5 degrees. On Thursday, it will be cloudy with showers in most areas. High of 12, low of 6 degrees. And for Friday, it will be cloudy with a 70% chance of showers. A high of 11 degrees, low of 5. Currently, it is 11 degrees with light rain in YVR. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
And thanks so much, Daniel, for that weather report. We now turn to Free Speech Radio News for your Monday headlines.
Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Inter-American Development Bank announced today that it will forgive almost $480 million in debt owed by Haiti. While releasing the island nation from one debt, they also offered a loan of another $2 billion for reconstruction and recovery from the earthquake that killed more than 230,000 people. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke today to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, the nation's largest pro-Israel lobby. Clinton reaffirmed U.S. commitment to Israel. She went on to explain the U.S. reaction to Israel's recent announcement of 1,600 new settlement homes in East Jerusalem.
It is our devotion to this outcome, two states for two peoples, secure and at peace, that led us to condemn the announcement of plans for new construction in East Jerusalem. This was not about wounded pride, nor is it a judgment on the final status of Jerusalem, which is an issue to be settled at the negotiating table. This is about getting to the table.
She also clearly reiterated U.S. demands for Hamas.
Our message to Hamas is clear. Renounce violence, recognize Israel, and abide by previous signed agreements.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also speaks to the lobbying group today. He meets with Secretary of State Clinton and Vice President Biden as well, and is set to talk with President Obama tomorrow. Meanwhile, along the Gaza-Egypt border, Israeli warplanes raided an underground tunnel. No injuries were reported, and Israeli media say that Gaza-based armed factions resumed firing homemade rockets into nearby Israeli areas. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Rami Al-Maghari is in Gaza. He brings us more.
Over the weekend, the Israeli army killed four Palestinians in separate incidents in the West Bank. Recently, Palestinians have stepped up protests over Israeli settlement plans in occupied East Jerusalem, which Palestinians consider the capital of a future Palestinian state. In Gaza, Hamas downplayed a visit by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who is in the region, to encourage all parties to resume peace talks. The UN has assisted in reconstruction efforts in Gaza following the January 2009 Israeli war. FSRN asked the Secretary General what prevents the repatriation of many thousands of Gazans displaced by the war.
That is exactly what I have been working and very hard and urging Israeli authorities to ease crossings so that all humanitarian materials can be shipped into Gaza so that this reconstruction can be continue.
Rami Al-Maghari, FSRN, Gaza.
The U.S. Supreme Court today let stand a lower court decision that prevents federal judges from stopping transfers of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. It's a win for federal authorities, allowing them to move detainees when and where they choose. District court judges remain unable to step in if a detainee objects to his transfer. Also today, the court left in place local restrictions on anti-choice protesters outside of clinics, and justices refused to hear two other cases as well, one on the federal government's role in stopping Asian carp in Lake Michigan, another on former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega's bid to avoid extradition to France. The High Court did, however, agree to hear a new case. They will consider the culpability of the New Orleans prosecutor's office in a case that resulted in the wrongful conviction of a man who was exonerated after 18 years in prison. Also in Washington, Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee withdrew hundreds of amendments to a financial reform bill today, clearing the way for a vote. The move avoids extended debate in the committee, and if it passes, the measure could make its way to the full Senate in a few weeks. The bill rewrites financial regulations intended to prevent another market meltdown. Six Mexican farmers opposed to the construction of a dam were gunned down over the weekend on their way home from a protest. Shannon Young has the story.
The victims belong to a movement of small farmers displaced by the Picachos Dam project in the state of Sinaloa. They had marched to the state capitol, erected a protest encampment inside the state legislature, and were on their way home when their pickup truck was riddled with bullets. All six passengers were killed. According to police, the farmer's pickup got caught in the crossfire of a shootout between two convoys of criminals. Three other bodies were also found along the highway murder scene. The farmers' movement has been carrying out a series of protests for more than a year now, demanding the government pay a fair price for their expropriated land. They have faced evictions, beatings, tear gassings, and arrests by state and federal police. Some of those displaced by the Picachos Dam marched through the state capital of Culiacan yesterday, accusing the state government of having a hand in the murders. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
A lesbian youth is in a Mississippi court today challenging her school's decision to cancel prom after she asked for permission to escort her girlfriend to the dance and to wear a tuxedo. The school district defended the cancellation of the April 2nd event, saying the issue was too much of a distraction. The ACLU is representing Constance McMillan in her bid to force officials to reinstate the dance at the school. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
And thank you to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. We now turn to CHRY in Toronto for an interview with Ihsan Gardi, the Executive Director of the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations, for an update on the Omar Khadr case.
Omar Khadr was sent to Guantanamo Bay in 2002 when he was captured in Afghanistan by U.S. forces when he was only 15 years old. He has been in Guantanamo Bay ever since and is the only remaining Western citizen in Guantanamo Bay and the youngest prisoner there. On January 29th, the Supreme Court of Canada released a judgment that Omar Khadr's human rights are being violated in Guantanamo Bay and that Canada was an active participant in this abuse. Though the judgment did not suggest a specific remedy and thus did not declare that the Canadian government should repatriate Omar Khadr back to Canada. Joining me on the line to speak about the case of Omar Khadr and the recent judgment is Ihsan Gardi, the Executive Director of the Canadian Council on American Relations. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show, Ihsan.
Alaikum salam. Thanks for having me on, Omay.
Okay, so we wanted to start off by asking you what circumstances or what was the situation that brought Omar Khadr to Guantanamo Bay and that is keeping him there? And also, if you could, just talk about how he's the youngest prisoner to ever go there and what does that mean?
Well, you covered a lot of it in your introduction, Omay. As you said, Omar Khadr is, or as some of your listeners may or may not know, he's the fifth child of seven children in the Qatar family, and he was captured by American forces following a firefight in exchange, and then since then he is was transferred to Guantanamo Bay, the Guantanamo Bay detention camps, where he has remained ever since. So, as you said, over 7 years now. And going on after that, there's been a series of attempts to have him repatriated in terms of legal motions put forward by his defense team here in Canada, as well as the defense in the U.S. has been doing its best to try and advocate on behalf of his case. As you said, he's currently the only remaining Western citizen being held at Guantanamo after governments from all other nations have used diplomatic pressure and made requests to successfully push for the return of their jailed citizen. Just recently as well, I don't know if your listeners are aware, but on Monday this past week, there was a story in the National Post that stated that U.S. officials are looking for a way to quietly to repatriate the Canadian-born Omar Khadr back to Canada. But, you know, obviously it will take some effort on behalf of the Canadian government to make that initial request.
And it's shocking, and maybe not so shocking, that Canada is not insisting on repatriating Omar back to Canada. He was born here. This is his home. His family is here. What is kind of behind that? I mean, it's obvious that it's racist, but what other, ideological underpinnings are beneath that? I mean, we're seeing increasingly that Muslim men are being targeted in this country more and more. And how does this kind of fit into that trend?
Right. Well, you know, Omar Khadr's case is, you know, has some peculiarities of its own. As you mentioned, he was part of the and as I mentioned as well, he was part of the Khadr family as well. And unfortunately, there have been some media appearances that have made this this family as a whole quite unpopular. And for some of the things that they've said, which, to be honest, have been not very helpful have hurt the public perception of Omar Khadr and his case. However, it's been Care Can's position, as well as that of several other social justice organizations, including Amnesty, UNICEF, and others, that, you know, the popularity of a person should not be the litmus test to determine whether or not somebody is accorded their rights. It's not a popularity case. Somebody is either accorded their rights or they're not. This is almost impossible to imagine happening 25, 30 years old, that Canada would not stand up for a citizen who, under international law, is, you know, recognized as somebody who would be a child soldier. He was 15 at the time he was captured. Canada has sort of prejudged from the beginning Mr. Khadr without allowing the trial process to proceed, basically saying that he's been accused of serious crimes. And the question, it begs the question, you know, since when does the seriousness of the indictment against a person mean that that defendant has fewer rights? Canada looks at murderers and break and enter criminals, they have equal rights. So it's just not logically correct to say that one has fewer rights than another. CSIS was involved in this, and Canada sent CSIS investigators to Guantanamo, which has been internationally recognized as a place that exists beyond the rule of law, an illegal institution where he was interrogated, and they interrogated him knowing that he'd been subject to sleep deprivation. A sleep deprivation program, which they term the frequent flyer program, where the subjects are woken up every few hours in order to make them more compliant to questioning. Rationalizing it that was okay because it was in the service of security, or perhaps to help our ally. And then, as you said, we have the Supreme Court ruling recently, in which the government argued that that the courts, don't have any say over what Canada's executive does abroad, even if it does it to Canadian citizens, is what essentially what the government argued, that it was immune from judicial scrutiny. which this, of course, translates into the fact that, you know, it's immune from having Canadian citizens seek the intervention of the courts. In any case, the government went on to argue that even if, you know, you do have something to say, the fact is that his rights weren't violated, and if they were, then, you know, we have already repaired that violation by handing over transcripts of that interrogation. Well, since when does handing over transcripts of somebody who's been tortured remedy the torture? It just, it makes no sense. So the Supreme Court ruling came back quite clearly, 9-0, basically saying, you know what, you're wrong, Canada. Omar Khadr's rights were violated. You were the one that violated Canada. Thirdly, you know, the violation is ongoing. And fourthly, there must be reparation for that violation. And it has to take into account two things. One, that the violation hurt his chances of defending himself, and it resulted in continuing detention under illegal circumstances.
And this recent judgment is part of a kind of a back and forth that's been happening for a few years, right? Supporters have been trying to get the Canadian government to do something, and they've been actively trying to not do something. This is not like it was the first case. It's gone through many different levels because the government keeps pushing back.
Correct. It does bear the hallmark, and it, you know, it, there are echoes of other cases like this of, you know, of Canadians having difficulty obtaining assistance from their government when they are in trouble abroad. Whether we look at the case of Abu Sufyan Abdulrazak, who, as you know, was stuck in Sudan for 6 years, or you look at the cases of, you know, the government involvement in the cases of the Maher Arar or Abdullah Al Malki, Ahmed Al Mati, Moyad Nuruddin, the three men. The other men, in addition to Maher Arar, who were tortured overseas. So it does bear many sort of eerie similarities to those cases in that it seems to suggest the government reluctance to assist its citizens and in protecting their rights while abroad.
And the recent judgment did mention that the Canadian government needs to do something, but did not specifically say what, right? Omar Khadr's supporters were hoping that the judgment would come back and say that the government needs to repatriate Khadr right away. So then what is, I mean, if the government needs to do something, what do you think that they're thinking that they'll do in order to comply with this judgment?
Well, you know, what the government has now come out and done is just a few weeks ago that they said that, okay, well, we will, what we'll do is we'll send a diplomatic note to Washington to basically ask the U.S., please kindly don't use the results of our interrogation in your case against Omar Khadr. Well, I think the Globe and Mail editorial on the government's response sort of characterized this quite well. They said this, what this was a right move, not the right move. Mm-hmm. So this is a very small step in the right direction that the government took, but it's still, as you said, it does not provide what is termed as a meaningful remedy to actually address the ongoing human rights violations.
And Hassan, in terms of the American government's or President Obama's election promise to close down Guantanamo Bay for good, where is that standing, and if is there still a possibility for that, and if so, how, what are the implications for Omar in that?
Well, I mean, you know, President Obama made a lot of promises during his election campaign, as a lot of politicians do. Now, obviously, once he's in office, I'm sure the reality of the situation on the ground in terms of the politics involved and the implications of making promises come fully to bear. And so there seems to be somewhat of a backpedaling on that promise. I think what was realized is probably a lot easier to in theory to look at closing it than when it came down to the reality of, well, what do we do once we close it? You know, the fact remains here that the Supreme Court of Canada has, even though they've made a decision which does not specifically require the government to repatriate Omar Khadr, they have maintained that you know, in the event that the government does not provide a remedy for the serious violations of the constitutional right, that, as I say, the court in quote says, in the case of a refusal by the government to abide by constitutional constraints, courts are empowered to make orders ensuring that the government's foreign affairs prerogative is exercised in accordance with the Constitution, unquote. And that's from the court's decision. So basically telling the government that, you know, if a remedy that does not address the ongoing violations is not made, that there is still room for the court to come back to this case.
And I'm wondering if you could tell us what kind of strategies are being thought about now to bring Omar Khadr home, so maybe CARE or any other kind of organizers that are organizing in solidarity with Omar Khadr, what's the next move?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Omay. If your listeners want to have more information about this case as well as any other case, I recommend they check out CARE CAN's website, which is just carecan.ca, that's CAIRCAN.ca, or they visit the websites of the other social justice, prominent social justice organizations working on this case, for example, like Amnesty International Canada, which is just amnesty.ca. There's another website, the Omar Khadr Project, that's just omarkhadrproject.com, all one word. In terms of sort of more proactive steps going forward at this point, I can let you know that I did speak with one of Omar Khadr's counsel today to get an update on sort of where they stand. What happened was, with regards to this diplomatic note that was sent, the government did not even consult with the lawyers to let them know that they were going to be taking this step. So basically, they just went ahead without consulting the lawyers. And at this point, the lawyers for Mr. Khadr here in Canada, Nathan Whitling, and his partner-in-law, Dennis Edney, are looking to perhaps even have that decision quashed, which might be counterintuitive, but their reasoning being that more should have been done, that, this remedy does not address the ongoing violation, and as such is not really a remedy. At the end of the day, what listeners can do is that obviously they can still write to the Prime Minister, to Prime Minister Stephen Harper, to their MP, to say that, the Supreme Court of Canada has unanimously declared that his human rights have been violated under Section 7 of the Charter, and that, it's clear that continued inaction by the Canadian government is simply not an option. He's endured now over 7 years of unlawful detention and harsh treatment in Guantanamo Bay. Now he's facing a military commission and a trial by a military commission, which, in spite of some of the reforms that it's undergone, still falls far short of international human rights standards. And as such, repatriation is, at this point, remains the only effective remedy. If he is brought back to Canada, then if there are charges against him, then he should be able to face those here in a fair and transparent judicial process. After that, there should be accommodation made for rehabilitation and reintegration into Canadian society for the sake of equality and justice for everyone, without exception.
Aysan, we are out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us today. And before we go, is there any last words that you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, again, I would encourage listeners that even though it seems like, the government is not listening, this is still a democracy that we're living in, and I would encourage them to write to the Prime Minister, which is just pm@pm.gc.ca. Look up their local Member of Parliament, write to their Member of Parliament, express their desire to have Omar Khadr come repatriate back to Canada, where if there are charges against him, he can face these here and then be allowed to have rehabilitation and reintegration.
Aysan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Omay.
Kodafis.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Aysan Gardi, the Executive Director of the Canadian Council on American-Islamic Relations, and he was speaking to us today about the case of Omar Khadr, who is a Canadian citizen being held a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay. He was captured in 2002 when he was only 15 years old.
And thank you to CHRY Toronto for bringing us that coverage. The time is 5:48, and we're going to take take a quick break for some public service announcements. Stay with us. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Do you have an approaching test or exam and need help studying? Well, it's time to prepare yourself. The Study Van, www.studyvan.com, is a 100% free website dedicated to helping you achieve excellence. MCAT, history, chemistry, French, math, biology, the Study Van covers it all. Tools are provided so you can create your own study group and do what you need to do. Ace your exam. The Study Van will help you help yourself. Give it a shot. You have nothing to lose, as once again, it's a 100% free studying resource. So remember, when you need to study, go to the Study Van, www.studyvan.com.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You're listening to News 101. We now go to News 101's own Kieran Cudahy for a roundup of international news and analysis.
Hi, I'm Kieran Cudahy, and welcome to another helping of international news and analysis. This week, we focus on the implications of a story that has been unfolding for the past several days, more particularly since the visit of US Vice President Joe Biden to Israel. For those who aren't aware of the details, the Israeli government coincided their welcoming of Mr. Biden with an announcement that they were going to begin building approximately 1,600 apartments on disputed land in largely Arab East Jerusalem. Israel has long sought to expand its influence in areas traditionally regarded as Palestinian by building high-density housing and populating same with Israeli citizens. The UN and the international community have largely condemned the practice as illegal, and cessation of this building has been regarded as key to any development in peace talks. Recently, the Israeli government had indicated that it had no further plans to construct such settlements and that they were open to direct face-to-face negotiations with the Palestinian Authority. Not only will this recent development call a halt to the prospect of any direct negotiations, but the timing of its announcement has been perceived by some to be an affront to the current US administration, who has in the past emphasized as one of its main aims the achievement of a lasting peace in the region. Vice President Biden was quick to condemn the Israeli plans.
Yesterday, the decision by the Israeli government to advance planning for new housing units in East Jerusalem undermines that very trust, the trust that we need right now in order to begin as well as produce and profitable negotiations. That is why I immediately condemned the action. As we move forward, the United States will hold both sides accountable for any statements or actions that inflame tensions or prejudice the outcome of talks, as this decision did.
The condemnation of Mr. Biden was quickly followed by more of the same from U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who had this to say when speaking to CNN during the week.
We have to make clear to our Israeli friends and partners that the two-state solution, which we support, which the Prime Minister himself has said he supports, requires confidence-building measures on both sides. And the announcement of the settlements on the very day that the Vice President was there was insulting. I mean, it was just really very unfortunate and a difficult moment for everyone. The United States, our Vice President, who had gone to reassert America's strong support for Israeli security, and I regret deeply that occurred and made that known.
The diplomatic row has been playing out since, with the representative of the Middle East Quartet, Tony Blair, and the UN General Secretary, Ban Ki-moon, both weighing in heavily. Ban Ki-moon was recently taking on a tour of the disputed region and took the opportunity to demand an end to the Israeli settlements. While this is an issue that has plagued every US presidency for over 40 years, it raises some interesting questions about the foreign policy of the Obama administration when viewed in the context of other global events. In January 2009, Barack Obama was sworn in as US president on a wave of goodwill, both domestically and internationally. In the first few months of his presidency, he was seen to reach out to the Arab world and signaled a clear intention to break from the policies of the preceding administration. He gave an interview to Arabic television channel Al Arabiya and followed this with a New Year's video message to the Iranian government and people. He spoke to large crowds in Turkey and Egypt, calling for a new beginning in relations between the United States and the Islamic world. The speeches were well received by many Arab leaders, with even the oft-hardline Syrian government describing them as important and positive. However, since last June, President Obama has seen his attentions forced to focus on a series of domestic issues, the most notable being the attempt to reform the healthcare system. In the meantime, much of that initial goodwill appears to have been squandered. In Iran, anti-government protests in the wake of disputed elections faced a brutal crackdown, the regime of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad paying little heed to US criticism. Iran also continues to vigorously pursue its nuclear ambitions, and as recently as this week, the Ayatollah heaped fresh scorn on the United States and its government in a televised message to the nation. The status quo has been maintained in Afghanistan, with the US continuing its support of a largely discredited Hamid Karzai as it struggles to maintain control of large swathes of the country. It emerged this week that the CIA was running a large private spy ring in the country, paying individuals to gather information on the whereabouts of Al-Qaeda operatives so that they could be targeted and killed. In diplomatic circles, it appears China has taken the measure of Obama and his administration and feels that it can act with relative impunity because of its economic clout. In Copenhagen, when Obama and other leaders met to hammer out a deal on climate change, the Chinese sent a low-ranking official, while Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao remained at home. Predictably, the meeting failed to produce the much-anticipated agreement. While it can be argued that positive steps have been taken in terms of both Iraq and the closing of controversial detention centre Guantanamo Bay, in many other international arenas, the Obama administration seems to be stumbling along from one issue to the next, without any clear idea of where it is going. Wanting to make the world a safer place does not make it so. In order for the president to justify all of that initial rhetoric and the subsequent Nobel Peace Prize, both he and his administration would have to emerge from their domestic hiatus with a renewed vigour and eager to tackle international issues. Otherwise, he faces the prospect of his foreign policy legacy sounding great in speeches but achieving little on the ground. That's all for this week. I hope you'll tune in again soon to CITR 101.9 FM for another dollop of international news and analysis with me, Kieran Cuddihy. Thanks for listening.
And thanks to Kieran Cuddihy for bringing us that coverage. And that's our program for March 22nd, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. Brad Pepping produced this radio program. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Andrew Longhurst. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Career Fast Track right here on 101.9 FM CITR. Here I am.